Thank you for being here with us this morning to worship together as we continue to explore and participate in the life of Jesus so that we can be a healing presence in our world. You know, our hope for each and every one of you is that you would find community that you can connect to, a community that's going to encourage and challenge you in your faith. And as the adult ministries pastor on staff, I get the opportunity to help cultivate these spaces where we can connect and find meaningful community, connect to the life of this community here at DCC. We have some really cool things coming up that I want to share about with you. First, there's just social ways to get connected, different social groups that we have here at DCC through Facebook. Groups that are just kind of finding times to go skiing together on the weekends or go out to lunch together. We also have ongoing community groups that you can connect to who are reading a book together or going through our weekly analog to study our teachings from Sundays a little bit further. These groups are also, we also have a community group that just goes out to lunch every Sunday after the gathering to connect. And then finally, we have ways that you can connect kind of one-time events, like our virtual trivia night that we have coming up on Friday, February 4th, where your team can just get together and participate in this trivia night with our community as well. So lots of ways to get connected. If you have questions about any of these opportunities, you want more information, I'd encourage you to go back to the participate area following the gathering this morning. One of our pastors, Brian Sawyer, will be back there. I know he'd love to answer some of your questions for you. You can also explore our website, or you can fill out one of the participate cards that is in the seat pockets in front of you. That card will come to me, and I will get in touch with you and give you some more details. So please reach out. We'd love to support you as you connect to the life of our community and get connected to some of these opportunities in the future. Finally, I want to invite you to give financially this morning. You know, your generosity as a community is always so incredible, and we want to thank you for all the ways that you continue to make it possible for our church to connect with and engage and explore the needs of our city and beyond. And so we're grateful for all the ways that you give. If you want to give this morning, you can give through a cash or check from the with the envelopes in the seat pockets in front of you, or you can give through our app. Finally, before we stand and continue to worship, I do want to acknowledge everyone on the platform this morning. You guys, every single person up here is a volunteer. Yes, please. They're volunteering their time, they're giving their gifts and their talents to help lead us and create this sacred space for us this morning. I want to thank David, too, who's new to our community and leading our worship team this morning. Thank you so much, you guys, for all that you give, not just here on a Sunday morning, but throughout the week, ways that you make it possible for us to enter into this sacred space. So let's go ahead and stand now, and we'll continue to worship together.
Darkness tries to roll over my bones. When sorrow comes to steal the joy I own. When brokenness and pain is all I know. No, I won't be shaken. No, I won't be shaken. My fear doesn't stand a chance when I say your love. My fear doesn't stand a chance when I stand in your love. My fear doesn't stand a chance when I stand in your love. Shame no longer has place to hide. To the last, I'm not afraid to leave my past behind. I won't be shaken. I won't be shaken. My fear doesn't stand a chance when I stand in your love. My fear doesn't stand a chance when I stand in your love. My fear doesn't stand a chance when I stand in your love. Oh, there's power that can break off every chain. Oh, there's power. Yeah. resurrection power that can save. Oh, there's power in your name. There's power in your name. My fear doesn't stand a chance when I stand in your love. My fear doesn't stand a chance when I stand in your love. My fear doesn't stand a chance when I stand in your love. My fear doesn't stand a chance when I stand in your love. My fear doesn't stand a chance when I stand in your love. My fear doesn't stand a chance when I stand.
All of you, someone on the way in said, it doesn't look like you're teaching today. And I said, why? And they said, because you're wearing the kind of sweater a professor wears when they're not teaching classes. Thanks, I guess. I don't know if it was a compliment or not. I did not take it. I just said thank you and kept walking. But I'm actually not teaching this morning, and I'm excited about that because, as I've shared the last couple of weeks, our friend Kent Dobson is here with us this morning. Kent and I have known each other for quite a while, and we are going to be leading a trip together again to Israel and Palestine in March. And so before I invite him to the platform, just know that after this gathering downstairs in our ballroom at 11:30, if you are interested in going, if you're planning on going, if you want to go in future years, we invite you to come and learn more about what that trip will be like. But at this point, I'm going to ask Kent to come to the platform and ask all of you to welcome him as he does.
Yeah, Michael and I have known each other for a while, like junior high, sixth grade. And here's a visual for you. We used to ride horses together, and so just imagine the two of us in like full Australian dusters and cowboy hats. That was before Michael got cool and wore sweaters with patches and stuff. So it's nice to be back. I've taught here many times, and it's such a welcoming and gracious place to be. And it's nice to be in a building like this, just because the architecture alone has a certain effect on the psyche and on the soul and on our sense of aim. So much of our life about what's important and what to pay attention to is now dictated by the almighty phone. And we know that. We're sort of like, well, yeah, I know that, but I'm going to now tweet that out on my phone. And human beings have always been in this dynamic relationship between ordinary space and sacred space. And it was sort of a question of, well, how do we find the sacred? And I don't mean anything super fancy by the sacred right this second. I mean something like a set-apart space, a space of depth where the divine and the human might meet. That was sacred space. And also you have this thing called ordinary space or mundane space. And where do the two meet? And one reason why people built buildings like this and gathered at certain set times during the week or during the year was to be in conversation with the sacred, because the mundane takes over the way your phone has taken over your life. Oh, probably not you, other people that you know. And it's good to be in spaces that pull us towards something larger, like how long would it take to make one of these stained glass panels with probably leaded glass, I'm imagining. I haven't looked that closely. How long would it take? Why would you do something like that? Why would you make something that might last for hundreds of years? especially in a culture where everything has to be instantaneous. Even COVID, give me the instantaneous vaccine. By the way, I'm not going to go on like a political rant here one way or the other, but give us the instantaneous vaccine so we can get over it. You know how long COVID is going to be here? I'm going to tell you, get ready, tweet it out, 10,000 years, something like that. That's the way infectious diseases move. That's slow. That's kind of humbling. It's like, okay, I'm not the center of the universe. I don't have that much control. And my question of is something like this. Where does the sacred and the mundane or the ordinary meet? And how does the sacred and the ordinary meet? Anyway, that was my intro. Let me read to you the passage that Michael gave me to riff on this morning. This is a passage that involves Mary, the mother of Jesus, and her relative, Elizabeth. And I'll just read it, and then I'll try to ask some questions about it. At that time, Mary got ready and hurried to a town in the hill country of Judea. So she's already pregnant, and she's going to visit Elizabeth here, where she entered Zechariah's home and greeted Elizabeth. When Elizabeth heard Mary's greeting, the baby leaped in her womb, and Elizabeth was filled with the Holy Spirit. In a loud voice, she exclaimed, "Blessed are you among women, and blessed is the child you will bear. But why am I so favored that the mother of my Lord should come to meet me? As soon as the sound of your greeting reached my ears, the baby in my womb leaped for joy. Blessed is she who has believed that the Lord would fulfill his promises to her." So when you're the lead pastor and you get to a passage that you're not sure what to say about it, you give it to a friend and you say, "Oh, I know, Kent should teach on this. That'll be good." Because it's a bit of a strange part of the story, a strange encounter here, where two women meet, and there's a kind of exchange that happens in the womb, a leaping and a filling of the Holy Spirit, and it's a kind of precious and mysterious encounter here. And why would the storyteller include this? I mean, it seems strange, and it seems numinous, to use a fancy word. Numinous means to wink or to nod. Like, well, I was going to say, like, if someone winks at you, I'm not going to wink at you right now. That might be weird, but you're like, oh, okay. But that's it's a numinous encounter. It's filled with mystery. And what's hidden here, the baby, what's hidden, it's like it's a wink toward the potential of something, of what's to be born in the world and what's to come to be in the world. And it also takes place in a kind of very ordinary sort of space. Two women getting together to talk about having babies, to be with one another. It's very plain in a way, very natural. And yet it's also filled with a kind of mysterious, numinous sort of presence. So where I want to begin is where anyone would begin with this passage, and that's to say a few things about archetypes and then talk about Socrates. So that's what I'm going to try to do. And then I'm going to ask a series of questions. So if you want to know what's the point of my talk today, it's going to be to ask a series of questions. By the way, what time am I supposed to end? In 26 minutes? Oh, I see the countdown. You said there's going to be a countdown. That's awesome. Okay. 25 minutes and counting. Here we go. So let's talk about archetypes. Archetype sounds like a fancy word, but it's really not. All an archetype is a pattern. It's a pattern. And an archetypal pattern is a pattern that's always true. And it's a it's an operating and energetic force in the world. I'll give you some examples of archetypes. A king or a queen. As soon as I say those words, there's a certain feeling about them. Certain images and emotions and ideas are floating in the air as soon as I say king or queen. Or here's another one, father or mother. When you become a mother or a father, you're not the first person to have done this. I don't know if you know this or not. You're joining an archetypal pattern that's true. That's always been true. It's kind of like a constellation in the sky. You know what, like if you don't know that much about the stars and you lay down and, you know, the clouds are not present and you're looking up, and at first, if you don't know anything, you're just seeing a bunch of dots, correct? Well, I know you are told they're stars, but what are you just seeing? Little white things. Someone at some point has to say, do you see those three stars that are kind of in a row? Well, that's the belt of Orion. You're like, oh yes, the belt of Orion. And then you have to be shown, well, he's holding a bow, and you see the arc of the bow. And after a while, if you lay there long enough and someone points out, you'll say, oh, he's shooting an animal, which he is. And you can see the head of the animal. And if you go even further than that, you can see the heart of the animal, which is called Plebeius or something like that, or the Seven Sisters. Now, probably none of that you're going to get on your first, you know, random chance to look up in the sky. It's a constellation. And once you see it, once you see the pattern, you're like, oh, there it is. That's what an archetype is. So archetypes like king, queen, mother, father, feminine, masculine, are constellations that carry energetic patterns. Now, why am I telling you all this stuff? Because the opening of the Gospel of Luke is interested in the feminine archetype and what that has to do with God. It's unusual to have so many verses and passages about women here at the beginning of the Gospels. It's unusual, and I'll tell you why in a second. It's asking questions like, what does the feminine teach us about God? What does the feminine reveal about the divine? See, all the way back in Genesis, it says a very interesting passage. It says, male and female, he created them. He created them in the image of God. That means whatever you want to say about God is both masculine and feminine. Both are incarnational expressions of the divine, or they show us something about the divine. And there's something very intriguing about what's happening here, and it's elevating the conversation around the feminine, which is an archetype, which is a pattern, which points towards something. What does the feminine know about the divine that the masculine does not? That's an interesting question. And all the men would say, well, nothing, nothing. It's poking around in that. It's pushing against it. In fact, in the Roman world, the testimony of a woman in court was not valid. Okay? So why would you be telling a story that involves so many passages about women? It's to balance out that, I guess you could call it, tendency of civilizations to lean toward what would be called the patriarchal or the masculine as the trustworthy source. So it's messing with these things. It's saying, oh, let's talk about the way in which the divine enters the world, and it involves the womb. It involves the womb. Whatever you think about the birth of Jesus, the birth of John the Baptist here, you have to admit that the divine enters the world through the feminine, through the mystery and danger of birth. There are no guarantees. Jesus could have died in childbirth. Why do I say that? Not because, you know, I'm like, I have some inside scoop. It's because lots of kids died in childbirth in the ancient world. What a vulnerable way to enter the human conversation. And it's elevating this, the Gospels are, saying, pay attention here. What does the feminine teach us about the divine that the masculine does not? That's a question I have. I'm not going to answer it. I'm just going to hold that question. It's also interesting that the story begins with women and ends with women. Only the women are at the cross. Where are all the men? I don't know. Hiding. Running away. Pretending they don't know Jesus. And the first person that Jesus appears to upon resurrection is a woman. We know more about Mary Magdalene in the Gospels than we do about Thaddeus, one of the 12 disciples. What do you know about Thaddeus? Nothing. I guess he wasn't that interesting. He was just like, he just sort of kept quiet, you know, like, hey, I'm on the team, but if I just lay low, you know, I won't get kicked out. So now, I'm really maybe overemphasizing this point, but I think it's important. Now I'll say something about Socrates, all right? Socrates was a philosopher, and philosophy means love of wisdom. That's the technical translation of philosophy. And one of the things that Socrates promoted was the suppression of emotions and the elevation of the rational, or the logos, it would be called in Greek, reason. And fair enough, all right? Suppress the emotions, be rational, be reasonable. And that is to be a philosopher, according to Socrates. And he was so disconnected from his emotions that at the end of his life, when he was given the choice between drinking poisonous hemlock and dying, or recanting and feeling emotions and saying, I'm sorry, he just, without emotion, apparently, according to the story, drank poison and died in Athens. And here's the interesting part of the story. His wife comes to see him. And his wife was known for being emotional. All right? I'm just telling you the story as it appears. And she's carrying on and saying, this is the last time I'm going to ever see you. And, you know, things you might say if your husband was about to drink poisonous hemlock and die. And what he says to his slave, Socrates, is get her out of here. All right. Those are his final words to his wife. Get her out of here. I can't handle this kind of emotion because I'm a philosopher. I'm a thinker. I've separated myself from the emotional life. Now, is that good or bad? I'll let you discuss that at lunch. But I might say something very obvious, which is you can't live like that for very long. It's imbalanced. You cannot just go through life logical, logos, ordered, aim, separation from emotions. I feel nothing. I'm just going to make the rational decision. It's not that good for you. And the masculine, I'm speaking archetypally, not necessarily of men, because masculine and feminine are, you know, not necessarily related to gender. But they're, again, like an energetic force, we could say, tends toward the rational. And the feminine tends toward something else, tends toward an embrace of the emotional life. And the Gospels are saying what's happening here cannot just be explained in terms of logic, rationality, and logos. The Gospel of Luke balances out the Gospel of John, which begins with these words. Now I forgot them. In the beginning was the Word. Yeah, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. Okay, in the beginning was logos. There it is. Socrates would be like, that's right. In the beginning was logos. And here in the Gospel of Luke, written by a man, interestingly enough, there's a flood of emotion, of spirit, of mystery, of the numinous, of babies leaping in wombs, tears, an overflowing of emotion, so much so that Elizabeth breaks into a poem here. The Spirit is involved, and she utters a blessing. And you'll see next week, what does Mary do in response? She sings a song. Well, why not just tell us what all this means and keep to the logos, you know? Keep to, you know, we want to know what to believe here. We want to know what to think. We don't need poems, you know? Poems are something that, you know, you read to a child. Little rhymes. So I'm saying all this facetiously, in case you're wondering. So there's an influx here of the muse, we might say. I'm going to say some more things about that in a moment. Okay. That was the second intro to the intro. 14 minutes. Now I have a series of questions. Oh, better not cover up the music. I have a series of questions. Here are things that sort of rise up in me that I'll offer. Just things to think about in light of this passage. So, here's the first one. Oftentimes we read the birth narratives, because that's what we're studying here. These are the early birth narratives of Jesus. And we read them as if they're, one approach would be as if they're just filled with theological points. Like, well, what's the point of the story? Well, the point is to make this theological point. And I'm not against theology. I suppose there's room for that. Another way we read it is kind of with some sentimentality. Like, remember that time when Jesus was born and he was there with the pine tree and the presents? And it's kind of nostalgic. We read the story like sort of just to feel sort of warm. It's like, I'm going to date myself, but it's like that old Saturday Night Live skit with Chris Farley when he's like the talk show host and he brings people on and he says like, hey, remember that time? And he brings Paul McCartney on. He's like, hey, remember that time when you were in the Beatles? That was awesome, you know? That's often how we read the birth narratives. Oh, remember that time when Jesus was in the manger, you know? Yeah, oh, that was so awesome, you know? And you know what we should do? We should like make little wooden, you know, things and put them up on the fireplace and light a fire because there was definitely a fire there at the first Christmas, and that was really awesome. And I'm not against these things. I actually like Christmas, but we read them with a certain amount of sentimentality. We might read them for theological points. And oftentimes we want them to tell us something about God. So here's the question that I'm asking here. What does this tell us about being human? That's my first question. What does this exact story of Elizabeth and Mary and the baby tell us about the nature of what it means to be human? Let me ask it another way. What does it tell us about the way in which we come to meet God? I don't mean the way in which other people back then came to meet God, and then we can make a little manger scene out of it. I mean right now, in the ordinary, mundane space called our lives. How does the mystery of the divine show up? And in what way? What about if just two people are talking? What about if two pregnant people are talking? What about a baby moving inside your womb? What does it tell us about, back to my original opening question, the sacred and the mundane? Where are they mixed? Where is the sacred mystery of God encountered? I'll tell you something that we have forgotten because Christianity has been a religion for so long, which tends to make whole bookshelves of ideas. We've forgotten that the point was to experience something. It says in the passage that she was filled with the Holy Spirit. It's saying that the mystery of God can fill you. That's what it's saying. The sacred divine mystery that ordered the cosmos. That's Genesis chapter 1. and the Spirit of God hovered over the waters, we feel, we taste, we touch when? Like when a baby moves. That's when. When we're just having like a face-to-face conversation with someone. And it moves out of, I cannot believe Green Bay lost that game yesterday, which is a fair point, to something where there's a trap door and something of the mystery enters. There's not a lot of mystery in Green Bay losing. I mean, it is a kind of mysterious now that I think of it, but probably the problem was Aaron Rodgers' hair. It got in his eyes and just couldn't see. I don't know why I said that. Okay. Here's question number two. I told you I'm just going to ask questions. Question number one was, what does this tell us about being human? About where and how the divine is encountered? And what kind of ordinary spaces that suddenly are shot through with the sacred? Here's another one that's related. How does the divine mystery dance with the ordinary? After all, we just have like our ordinary lives. Like I woke up this morning and I just woke up. I'm just doing things, drinking coffee and, you know, hanging out, I guess, and getting ready to go and do the special thing, like speak in front of people. It's all just relatively ordinary space. And how does the ordinary dance with the mystery of life, with the mystery of God, with the divine? How? Is it possible for me to say yes to that dance? Is it possible for me to resist that dance? What kinds of things make that dance more lively, more visceral, more real? Here's another question I might ask. This is kind of a whole nother rabbit hole, like in Alice in Wonderland here. What does this story tell us about the nature of initiation? So initiation is a word that's kind of gone out of favor. It actually technically means to begin. Now, I'm not going to ask you to raise your hands. Actually, that might be fun. How many of you have had experiences in life that seem to have ushered you from one stage of life to the next and you can't go back? Anyone had an experience? Yeah, that's called initiation. And cultures created rituals and songs and poems and stories and myths and legends to help people transition, because it's not that easy. I'm going to let you into a little secret, especially in America. Young people have a hard time growing up. We have a hard time reaching adulthood. And I'm not actually picking on young people, I'm picking on adults. You know, we have a hard time being initiated in the sense of being ushered into the next stage of life, which always involves suffering, always, and always involves opportunity. Those two things are mixed together, and you can't go back. We want to resist it. We want to play video games forever, like metaphorically, or sometimes literally, I guess. But and this is a story of initiation. Mary and Elizabeth cannot go back. Mary cannot go back. She can't go back to childhood. It's done. And there's a fair amount of suffering and hardship and heartache in the story. What is she even doing in Judea? Why is she wandering away? Maybe she got kicked out of her own house. That happens. I don't know if you know this, but if you get pregnant as a teenager, sometimes parents aren't like, how wonderful. We're so glad this happened so early, you know? The opposite tends to be the case. And it's possible, we have no idea because we don't know enough about the story, but it's possible that's exactly what's happening to Mary. So talk about an initiation. Talk about an initiation into adulthood. Yeah, and the story is one of being ushered by no choice of her own. I mean, there is a kind of consent that's in the previous passage where she says yes to the divine, but it comes with a lot of pain and suffering and loss and confusion and not knowing where to go and not knowing what to do. Back then, they didn't have that book, What to Expect When Expecting, or whatever that book is. Isn't that it? I think there's also What to Expect When Expecting 2, which I thought was kind of funny. They apparently missed a bunch of things. Okay. Here's another question I have. What does this tell us about the need, I'm going to use an Irish phrase, about the need for an anamkara, it's called. This is a soul friend. You know the difference? Of course you do. Of course you know the difference between a friend and a soul friend. You know, your soul friends are the ones that you have on Facebook. I'm telling you something. COVID is a massive invitation. It's a massive invitation by Mother Nature. And all I want to say about it right this second, because it's an invitation to a bunch of things, but here's one thing. What's really important? Who is really important? And acquiring numbers on a screen or little thumbs up is not important. And we know that, but we don't know that. And I don't know, COVID's like, all right. Not that COVID is like an autonomous personality, but it's like, all right, let's see what's important here. So what's my point right this second? Do you have an anamkara, a soul friend? That's what's happening in this passage here. This is a soul friend encounter. And you can feel it in your guts. Actually, if I translate this from the Greek, I know it says really pretty, and the baby leaped in her womb, but it's really something like the baby wrestled, which is another translation, in her guts. Now, have you ever felt something in your gut? Like been stirred in your gut, in your core? Like really stirred? Yeah. Have you ever been really stirred in a conversation with a friend? The story is saying that's where God shows up. Because the very next line is, and she was filled with the Holy Spirit. When someone looks at you, really looks at you with presence, and you look back with presence and you see something, you see the other, and the other sees you, that's a soul kind of encounter. And that's where God is. That's what the story is saying. That's where the Spirit is. I know the Spirit sounds very technical, like Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and we have this like way of arranging things, like, oh, I understand God, it's a Trinity. Okay, all right. Try to explain it, and then you can't. And then you say, never mind. The Spirit, I'll give you the technical translation of the Spirit, just so you know we're on the same page here. It just means the wind. That's all it is, the wind of God. What a weird thing. It's also feminine, by the way, in Hebrew. The feminine wind of God is present. And it shows up. And what happens when the animating Spirit of God, the creative Spirit of God, the feminine Spirit of God that brings order out of chaos in Genesis chapter 1 begins to move in your gut? Well, you begin to sound like a poet all of a sudden. It's like you're falling in love and suddenly you're writing poems, you know, or something like that. You're speaking things that are true. That's what happens in a soul encounter, in a anamkara relationship. So do you have any? That's my question. Do you have any? Do you care enough to sit with someone and really look them in the eyes and allow yourself to see and be seen? What might happen? What might be born in the wake of that? What poem, what piece of art? Or, and I don't mean that technically necessarily, but what kind of inspiration or muse might arise? Let's see if I got more questions. All right, maybe I'll just make a few comments here. 1 minute. So, the story suggests to me something like this, that we ought to pay attention to the ordinary if we want to deepen our relationship with the mystery of God. And I mean really ordinary things like talking to someone who's pregnant or talking to someone who's not, who lost a baby recently, or talking to someone who can't get pregnant, or talking to a friend, you know, at work about something real, or calling someone on the phone. That's the other part of your phone that doesn't text. Calling someone on the phone and asking them questions about the ordinary. I think this story is saying that God is much closer to the ordinary than we think. And much closer to the thing that we call just life than we think. And we don't need, not that I'm against them, library books full of ideas. We just need the ordinary. And sometimes in the ordinary space, that's where the sacred shows up. That's where our own guts churn. And something like the wind of the mystery moves again in this thing that we call life. So my final question is something like this. What is the nature of your own experience? I mean, really, what is the nature of your own experience? And if you say, what is the nature of my own experience and the divine? Even if you're at a loss and you're like, I don't know, that's a good place to start. You don't have to pretend. It's not like God is like, just please pretend, fake it till you make it. No, just, what is the nature of my own, what is my experience of my own life? And I think a related question is something like, how might God be making God's self known in the ordinary thing I call my life? So I want to end by just reading the passage again, and as the musicians come up, I just want you to hear, try to listen with your imagination. In fact, try to listen with your gut, all right? Try to listen with your gut. Here's the passage. At that time, Mary got ready and hurried to a town in the hill country of Judea, where she entered Zechariah's home and greeted Elizabeth. When Elizabeth heard Mary's greeting, the baby leaped in her womb. And Elizabeth was filled with the Holy Spirit. In a loud voice, she exclaimed, "Blessed are you among women, and blessed is the child you will bear. Why am I so favored that the mother of my Lord should come to me? As soon as the sound of your greeting reached my ears, the baby in my womb leaped for joy. Blessed is she who has believed that the Lord would fulfill his promises to her." Thanks for listening.